Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Shame is one of those universal feelings, especially if you're a woman. 70% of teenage girls feel shame about their bodies. 3 out of 4 executive women struggle with imposter syndrome. And working moms, we feel all kinds of shame about our work-life balance. In short, women feel a lot more shame than men, more pressure for perfection. So what do we do about it? This pervasive and sometimes pernicious sense of shame. Author Melissa Petro explores this question in her new book, Shame on You: How to Be a Woman in the Age of Mortification. And Melissa joins me now. Welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
Shame on You opens with a press conference where you publicly, very publicly, resign from your job as a school teacher after having been outed as a former sex worker by the New York Post. I'll spare everyone the headlines they chose for their stories, but it's a moment you describe as a national humiliation. And quite honestly, I don't know how you stood up there and read that statement.
Honestly, I don't know how I did it either. You know, at that point, I'd had a lot of done a lot of deep personal work to prepare me for, public school teaching, which is a really difficult and, you know, challenging and beautiful career that I had chosen 4 years prior. And as you said, unfortunately, I was the target of just mass media humiliation, first by the New York Post, and then it just went like wildfire. People ran with that headline that a Bronx public school teacher had once been a woman with experiences in the sex trade, that I was a former sex worker. And, you know, it was just incomprehensible. One, that I was both a teacher and a former sex worker, but also that I had chosen to talk about it publicly. Even people who agreed with me just couldn't understand why anyone wouldn't keep that just a secret forever. But I really, part of why I was able to stand up there and, you know, read a statement to the press corps was because I had done so much work to just not feel ashamed of who I was then, in spite of relentless shaming.
I love the detail in the opening scene about the clothes you wore, because I have never experienced that level of public humiliation. I pray I never go through that. Mm-hmm. But I know what it's like to pick clothes like you're picking a suit of armor. And I felt like that was a very relatable part of it. Like, when you're really scared or embarrassed or nervous, I definitely try to dress in a way that gives me confidence I might not feel.
Right. It's interesting because when the book came out, I was doing an author's photo, and that same feeling of fear of and wanting to be invulnerable. Like, I don't want people to look at me and criticize me. And so I'm going to control every aspect of my appearance to avoid that. That's how we respond to the fear of shame. We try to become invulnerable so that we won't be criticized. And the truth is that we can't avoid criticism, especially if you're a woman and you're putting your real self out there. People are going to find fault, especially in our culture of shame, as I describe it in the book. People are finding fault mercilessly with everyone all of the time. It's no wonder we're afraid to just be natural and ourselves. And certainly in that moment, I was terrified.
Yeah, I know. So I have this joke that the more nervous I am for an interview, the higher my high heels. Right. I'm 5'9" naturally. And so in my big girl heels, I'm a little over 6 feet. And I've often found that if I was having, you know, conversations with male political leaders, it's hard to talk down when you have to look up.
Right. It's so interesting. In the process of writing this book, I had the privilege to speak with over 150 women about all their different shame triggers. For me, I'm also short, and I love being short. But for other people, that can be a pain point, a point of vulnerability. Yeah. That they try to mask. And it's just so interesting to see that it's not necessarily what you or I would feel ashamed of, but this other person might have this deep fear and feel incredibly vulnerable about this aspect of themselves. And the need to hide that, that's the feeling of shame.
Yeah. So at what point did you know you wanted to write a book about shame?
It's really interesting because I didn't for a very long time. I just thought I needed to write a book about what happened to me personally. I didn't, I might have known that I felt ashamed, but I didn't know how central that experience was to my experience, and I didn't know how universal it was. And so working with my agent and speaking with other writers, I really discovered, and I should say, becoming a mother. That was a real eye-opener for me. That made me realize just how ubiquitous this feeling was. It wasn't that I had made this terrible mistake at 19 years old that it just scarred me for life. And it was constant as a mother. I was constantly being made to feel inadequate, less than, and just fundamentally bad and wrong because I couldn't live up to these impossible expectations. That's shame. And it's the same feeling. Whether I burn my kid's waffle or I forget their socks, or I'm being outed on the cover of the New York Post as a former sex worker, I'm just not living up to what I'm supposed to be as a woman. And then that really, then it came to me. This is what this book is about. It's not what happened to me. It's what's happening to all of us all of the time.
Yeah, we're definitely going to talk more about shame as it relates to motherhood, but I want to define shame because early on in the book, you sort of help us suss out the difference between emotions like embarrassment, guilt, and shame. And I hadn't really thought a lot about how different they are.
I hadn't thought a lot about how different they were either until I had the privilege of doing this work for this book. And I didn't really, embarrassment are these like light feelings of self-consciousness that we all share and we recognize it as a universal experience. It sort of happens to all of us at one point or another. Shame is not that. We do not think that it's universal. We don't think that it's that other people are also having this experience. We're really connecting it to this like fundamental wrongness or flaw within ourselves that needs to be hidden. Whereas embarrassment, we can laugh. We don't laugh about something we're ashamed of. Not really, not in an authentic way. For me, the hardest difference was shame and humiliation because for a long time, I didn't really recognize what had happened to me as a humiliation, that people were impressing their power over me to put me down, to make me feel less than, and that it was wrong. Yes, on some level, I recognized that my public humiliation was wrong, but I still internalized it. And oftentimes, if a humiliation persists, even when we recognize it as wrong, we do internalize it to at least some extent. And so that was my experience. It was a humiliation, but I also felt at some level ashamed. I thought there was something I should have or could have done differently to avoid this. And that's what we feel when we're being shamed. We're thinking it's even when we know it's wrong. I shouldn't feel ashamed of this. There's a part of us that feels somehow responsible for what's happening to us.
Yeah, and guilt, what I loved about it is, I mean, we can feel guilty when we have done something wrong, and that's normal, that's fair. We should feel guilty about hurting others or doing something that we believe to be morally or spiritually wrong. But I like that it's we've done something wrong, where you define shame as we are wrong.
Absolutely. So when we feel guilty, we can change our behavior. But when we feel ashamed, we just feel hopeless because it's this aspect of ourselves. The only thing we can really do is hide it. We can't change who we are, we fear. So it's really important when we're not really measuring up to our own ideals, to shift that shame into that place of guilt so that we can identify the behaviors that need to change in order to live up to the standards that we wish to.
Yeah, because I think I can feel guilty about snapping at my kid because I had a really bad day. But the shame part of it is real. And you know, one of the things I liked is you really describe how visceral that reaction can be, how we experience shame in our bodies.
Unless we don't, unless we try to bypass the feeling, which then we can't really learn from it. But when we start to really recognize that feeling in our body, then we can start to one, it slows us down. We're not going to react immediately. We get defensive, get angry, eat or drink or do something just to make ourselves feel better. Instead, really living with that feeling and feeling it for that moment and identifying the pain, then we can make more intelligent decisions about what to do next.
Yeah, you describe all these different reactions like flight, fight, freeze, fawn. And, I thought a lot about how I experience shame. I almost wince and want to close my eyes like a cat. Like if I can't see it, it's not happening.
Right. Well, and if I can't see you, you can't see me.
And I didn't realize how often it can bring out anger. That was surprising to me.
Well, those hard feelings can really protect us. And oftentimes we're also very angry at ourselves, right? Because, we're just, we really, people want to feel as if they belong. We want to feel accepted and loved. And this feeling is the opposite of that. It's a disconnection. It's the feeling that we're just not measuring up and ultimately that we're not lovable. So it's a really, really painful feeling. And we would rather do feel anything but. So if it's, shouting at your partner or blaming them or anything other than just kind of sitting with that pain of not measuring up and the fear that someone else will really perceive me as not good enough.
Yeah, one of the points you discuss in the book is that shame develops over time. Like there was a time as a child where you felt no shame.
Right. We're totally uninhibited. Right, because we don't really know what's allowed and not allowed, and then we start to learn these rules, and we learn them from our immediate family, and then that greater culture, and we find ourselves in these rules and how we behave or want to behave. There's an incongruence, right? So enter shame. That's when we start to think, oh, I don't want to, or I didn't follow that rule. What's really interesting, though, is sometimes rules, especially in our society, are shouldn't be followed. Even our parents, sometimes they're imposing a rule upon us that might not really match our own ideals. And children are pretty intelligent, and so we start to have that cognitive dissonance early on.
Yeah, and what's interesting is you also explore the sort of what anthropologists might see as the value in shame in society over time, the idea of societal cohesion.
Right. And some people believe that shame can be positive because it convinces us to follow the rules. In order to avoid that pain, I'll fit in. I'll follow what society is prescribing as the norm. What we understand is, wrong with that is, sometimes society's rules, again, don't match up to our own ideals. And when we really look at society, if we want to believe in positive shame, the research really, really discounts that. Because if we look at how shame impacts an individual, they're more likely to, become depressed or abuse substances. There's really like poor health outcomes and related to shame. And then if we think about it societally, like who's really feeling shame or expressing, showing shame? It's not the CEOs who are cheating on their wives. It's the mistress or the pregnant wife at home who's hiding away and feeling somehow responsible for the experience that they're enduring. It's rarely really the people that if we really value if we investigate our values, we'll find that we're not shaming the people who really meet our values.
Yeah, I thought that was a really interesting part of the book. You have interviews with about 150 different women and gender nonconforming people about that concept. And you even talk about really infamous cases like Monica Lewinsky and who ends up feeling shame in these situations.
Right. And I looked at my own experience. And, when I thought about what I was enduring versus, men who frequent sex workers or other or politicians who'd been caught behaving, transgressing, they were back on TV, and they were, their careers were like, it was barely a hiccup. Whereas I was unemployed and unemployable, and I really knew that that was going to be my fate for from then on. And to a large extent, it really did pan out, because I don't work in nonprofit sector anymore, even though I have, 5+ years experience and degrees, and a wealth to contribute to public life. This has been a real, a mark against me in a way that it just didn't affect men. I understood that immediately, and it's still true.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how society emphasizes the shame that women feel. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. In Melissa Petro's new book, Shame on You, she tells the stories of how women experience shame and how we experience it every day. Mothers who berate themselves for growing laundry piles in toy-strewn rooms, and how the instinct is to tack more onto our already long to-do lists. We see it with the treatment of public figures like Monica Lewinsky, Anita Hill. It feels like society might be built to expect more from women. And what happens when we just can't meet those expectations? Still with me is the author and journalist Melissa Petro. You know, Melissa, as I was reading your book, I kept coming back to this scene from the movie Marriage Story, where actress Laura Dern is giving Scarlett Johansson advice on her divorce. And here's the clip.
People don't accept mothers who drink too much wine and yell at their child and call him an a-. I get it. I do it too. We can accept an imperfect dad. Let's face it, the idea of a good father was only invented like 30 years ago. Before that, fathers were expected to be silent and absent and unreliable and selfish. And we can all say we want them to be different. But on some basic level, we accept them. We love them for their fallibilities, but people absolutely don't accept those same failings in mothers. We don't accept it structurally, and we don't accept it spiritually, because the basis of our Judeo-Christian whatever is Mary, mother of Jesus, and she's perfect. She's a virgin who gives birth, unwaveringly supports her child, and holds his dead body when he's gone. So you have to be perfect, and Charlie can be up, and it doesn't matter. You will always be held to a different, higher standard. And it's f***ed up, but that is the way it is.
What I love about Laura Dern's character there is I think it rings so true to me that the bar for good mother and the bar for good father are in two totally different places.
You know, and it is changing now. And as a result, men are feeling more shame too, because the expectations for the modern man are becoming equally impossible.
Yeah, it's one of those big areas where shame comes into play in a woman's life. Particularly, women are shamed if they don't want to become a mother or if they want to keep working when they're a mother. It feels like we have this very strong idea still, even as we get more accepting of women who don't want children, that like somehow there's something fundamentally wrong with them.
That there's fundamentally wrong with children?
No. That, sorry.
Oh, with women?
like this idea that if you don't want kids, there's something broken within you.
Well, there's something wrong with us no matter what. I mean, whether you want kids, whether you if you don't want kids, if you want to work, if you don't want to work, what's the common denominator here? It's, women are really punished And it's about compliance. You know, if we're feeling afraid and trying to follow these impossible expectations, we're more likely to do what the systems need us to do, which is all of this unpaid, invisible labor. And we really survey each other and heap it on ourselves. You know, so what do we do about it? We have to start noticing how we speak to ourselves, notice our own expectations, and we can start to begin to change at least that, because we're our own wardens to a great extent. In society, this culture won't might not change, not very quickly. But we can start to change within ourselves and within our family systems.
Yeah, it's funny. I never fully appreciated how there were different standards until I became a mother, just like you said. And my husband is objectively a good dad. Like he doesn't babysit his kids; he parents his kids, but he takes them like to the grocery store, to the hardware store, to the park. Like he does things with his daughters because he likes them, and because that's his job. But the number of people, and he tells me about this, and I'm just blown away. The number of people, particularly old women, who have
That
come up,
compliment him.
yes, who have come up
Right.
to him at the grocery store or Home Depot and been like, "What a good dad. You girls are so lucky. Your mom is really lucky. You have such a good dad." And I'm like, it would never happen to me. It would feel weirdly pedantic if someone came up to me at Kroger and was like, "What a good mom taking your kids to the grocery store."
So that's something we can start doing for each other, right? And doing for ourselves. We can start, and I've gotten it probably because I'm just like such an unapologetic hot mess everywhere I go. You know, when my kid was having a meltdown in the grocery store on his father's birthday, and I body slammed him on the like conveyor belt to get him to let go of my hair. Like she just looked at me and said, "You're doing a good job, mom. Like you're doing your best." Because there are those moments where we need to hear that from someone else to remember it for ourselves. So we can start giving each other that same grace. I don't want to like not give dads like
No,
the
it's just.
support that we all need, but what's important is we all need it. We all need grace. When I forget my kid's hat, instead of looking at me critically, like I'm already looking at myself, you know, help me or let it go, because there's so many things on our plate, right? And ultimately, like, as a mom, you know, like that hat's not going to make or break it. Not today, probably. So, like, let's give each other and ourselves a break.
Yeah, like I'll have to figure out a non like weird way to be like, "Hey, you're doing a great job grocery shopping with your kids." 'Cause it feels
I mean,
weird, but
truth, and actually, I'll say, I think social media is starting to facilitate that for each other, because it's like we see so many funny memes about how hard it is to take two kids to the grocery store or whatever. Like it is hard. Like it's hard. This is hard work. We don't have social systems that are supporting us. So we're doing it on our own, and we're doing a pretty good job. And we want to start to recognize that, I think.
yeah. One of the things I liked about the book is you say that sharing your stories of shame is a way to work through it. And you have deeply, deeply personal stories in this book. Was it difficult to get people to open up about it?
Not at all, because I went to people who already knew me. They knew my story. They'd been following me for years, or you know, they came to me like moths to a light, like gravitating towards the place where they could be true, and that's really how I live. And so I think there's this deep yearning from people to just live out loud. And yeah, you're not always. It's not always returned to you. That sort of vulnerability. You know, what happened the other day? I went somewhere and I forgot my kid's shoes. It's winter here. My kid was not wearing shoes. It was either go home and not go to that thing or let them be there without shoes on. And you know, someone pointed it out, and I might have said what I just said to you. It was either go home or be here, and here we are, doing my best. And in that moment, that person has a choice. They can either see me see, hear, and understand my experience, my struggle that day, or they could reject me. And sometimes we're rejected when we tell the truth of our experience to someone. And some of us have experienced it in profoundly painful ways. We've experienced profound rejection when we've come out as who we are. And that's very affecting. And there's reasons why people just don't like run around telling their truth. But when we're desperate enough, like I have been in my lifetime, we discover the power of telling our truth and we find the people who can hear it. So yeah, when I did those interviews, those people knew that I was going to create a safe container for us, where they could just be completely honest. And it's about no judgments. It's about, you know, maybe the behavior isn't something I would condone, but I would never condemn a person for their behavior.
Yeah, and in some of them, you write that you were surprised. You had a close mom friend who confesses to self-harm as a way of regulating the shame that she feels. And I love that you write, you know, from the outside, I thought she had it all together. I thought she had the best kid, the best marriage of anyone in the group.
Yeah, it was wonderful because this was a mom I had previously compared myself to and felt despair that I just couldn't live up to what I recognized as, you know, her perfection. She seemed invulnerable to me. So that she was able to share that with me, I could have, again, I could have gone in either direction, right? And initially, and we've been conditioned to have this response, I felt a little titillated by it, right? Like, ooh, this is like juicy gossip, right? Really? I can't believe she does that. We have to move through that feeling because, again, that's the feeling we've been conditioned. That's that conditioned reaction. Where's the empathy? So moving a little further, maybe I feel a little like, ooh, I'm a, you know, now my, if this were competition, I don't do that, you know. So then we move through those feelings, and then we find the truer feeling that connects us, which is, you know, I might not do that, but I know how it feels. To be in that kind of pain and that struggle. And that's her response to it. And my response might look differently, but the feeling is the same.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about too is this push for perfection in women. Perfection in looks, perfection in career, perfection in relationships. And as somebody who has always jokingly referred to herself as a perfectionist, I have to say it was an unpleasant revelation that so much of that is driven by shame.
Well, and also it's really impossible to be perfect because the expectations compete.
Yeah.
So if it's, you know, perfect to like be like a power working mom, and but it's also perfect to be the like stay-at-home mom who just idolizes her children, the selfless wife and mother. You know, it's impossible to be both. And it's also really culturally driven. When you start to diversify your friend groups, you realize that like what one person aspires to appear as, another cultural group just wouldn't value that same thing. So we have to start recognizing, well, what do we value? What works for our families? What works for me as an individual? And then we can start to be more mindful about our behaviors and our choices because you can't please everyone. And perfection is this idea that everyone will be pleased. And you know, we know that's not true or possible.
Yeah. And you can definitely burn yourself out trying.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. Like, if I gave you a tour of my home, like, I have aspirations and
Oh,
aesthetic
yeah.
aspirations. You know, I want to look a kind of way. And I can burn myself out trying too. And there's so much hidden in, you know, that we don't want seen. I don't want you to see that I haven't gotten my hair colored for 8 months because I can't afford to drop 400. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I want to look professional. And we have this idea that like professional people appear one way and they don't struggle the way, you know, a normal person. And we think everyone is some way normal is this other idea, this other appearance. And, you know, I think one thing we can start to do for each other is to break that down. And we can break it down in conversations. You know, when someone asks you how you're doing, what's your answer?
Oh, I'm doing
We're
great. It's good.
fine,
Yeah.
great, even.
Yeah.
But are you? You know, sometimes you're not. And you can be like, you know, I'm feeling this kind of way today. And again, some people are going to be like, whoa, TMI. You know, and other people are going to be really grateful for the opportunity to be real.
You know, I think social media is such a double-edged sword here because on the one hand, yeah, you can see more people, women in particular, having these conversations about expectation versus reality. But it also can give us, on the flip side, this very curated, very stylized, very impossible standard.
Right. So I think it's really about being cognizant of your media diet and curating that timeline. So what kind of influences do you want getting into you and your life? You know, which influencers are you going to choose to follow, and which ones, sometimes it's interesting, we'll kind of like hate follow, or we'll follow it even though it feels bad, right? Like, oh, this person makes me feel bad, but
I'm nodding along here because yes,
I'm gonna continue following again. And you know, it be honest about that. when I find myself, you know, whether it's, you know, like a home decor or diet or, you know, just these like aspirational figures, you know, we want to be mindful of the impact that the media we're choosing has on us, because there are, like you said, there's such a diversity of media that we can choose to consume. And if we consume media and take in influencers that are feel nourishing and that make us feel more connected to our true self versus an aspirational self, there's a payoff in the end.
Yeah, I got married before the rise of Pinterest, but I had children during the age of Pinterest. And it is funny to kind of think like, okay, my wedding looked a certain way because I didn't have all of that. But like the idea of being a perfect Pinterest mom is like definitely a thing for millennial women.
Yeah. And I'm like, I still have like, I curate my timeline and I have like, you know, we're allowed to have like a presentational self.
Yeah.
And that's part of who we truly are. You know, that is also authentic. But there's so much we're not showing, right? And that is also true. And we have to remember that other people also have, you know, the piles of laundry kind of rotting in the corner. No one's taking a picture of that and putting it online unless that's their brand, right? So the more real we can be interpersonally, but also publicly, the more real we can be in our timelines is also, there's all of these opportunities to be real. And I just need to say like how it feels when we're actually authentic. Like, I know the opposite. I know how it felt to hide who I was and to lie and deceive others because I was terrified of them knowing my truth. It's so freeing to instead, even the most untidy, regrettable, the behaviors, the things we feel guilty about, you know, we can start to embrace the truth of our experience today to make our experience feel better and look differently in the future. Shame will never instigate positive change, but truly being who you are and owning every part of yourself, no matter how messy, there's so much liberation that comes from that and opportunity, because then you can improve yourself. It's ironic. We think, oh, we want to be a better person. I'll just, you know, tough love myself into being better because I'm not good enough as I am. And yet, ironically, when we start to really embrace who we are today, you can become better.
You know, I really loved the mom who seemed to have it all together. That was really reassuring for me. But were there other stories that really resonated with you where you're like, oh, okay, somebody else experiencing that too?
One of the most powerful stories was I talked to, and in my chapter 6, I really talked to a lot of shame resilient women, like really powerful women who'd lived through something very dramatic and painful typically, and just come out better on the other side, just so much more human and whole and self-embracing. You know, there's a mom who went through a violent marriage all the way to the other side. It's funny too, because a lot of her and other women that I'd interviewed who'd gone through difficult breakups and a divorce, end of a marriage, a lot of them are like remarried now and they've got the beautiful, like perfect on the outsides kind of life. But to get there, they had to be at their worst, and they had to be it all the time and not hide those facts. To see the courage and the bravery, the commitment even that these women made to themselves, those were the most inspiring stories I witnessed. And it's funny too, that mom in particular talked about how many compliments she got during that time in her life, because when she went through her divorce, her eating disorder flared up again. So she was losing a lot of weight. So people were complimenting her body. And she told me, be real with these people and say, no, I'm not doing well. This is not because I'm doing well. This is because I'm really, really having a hard time. And as a result of saying it out loud, she was really able to, she said, pick out the people who had her back and the people who couldn't hang. And she just went through them. And she really created a strong network of people who had her back. And that is all I want for anyone. I want you to have people who've got your back. And you can really only find those people when you're true about who you are.
Coming up, we're going to talk about how to cultivate that kind of shame resilience. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. She's a working girl once again. That was the first line written in yet another New York Post article criticizing Melissa Petro's career. More than a year after she had lost her job as a teacher, she started teaching writing classes to adults. And a New York Post reporter decided to chronicle what she had been up to. Petro read the article, angrily watched as the reporter climbed the career ladder, but years later, she reached out, started his conversation. Melissa Petro is the author of Shame on You, and she's still with us now. You know, the ending to the book, this conversation between you and this New York Post reporter, felt like such a great parallel to the press conference opening.
You know, I loved that I had the opportunity, and I love that this happened. I was doing research for the book, and I kind of, again, you know how we hate follow people, right? She was someone I had hate followed meticulously throughout her career. I'd really paid attention and measured myself against her. You know, so before the break, you mentioned, you know, shame resilience. You know, how do we become resilient to shame? Well, our first step of that is to know our triggers. Like, I'm super triggered by like any kind of class issues. If I think someone's got more class than me, they're classy. I'm not classy. You know, that's my fear. That's my unwanted identity. So she's like super classy, right? And she's just, you know, I was a stripper, she did ballet kind of comparison. I don't know if that's true, but that's my brain, right? It creates this. So this person existed. And I was able to feel that feeling when I came across her timeline for whatever reason. I was doing the research. And, you know, I made a decision to reach out to her. And to her credit, she was willing to meet me and have a conversation, which is so brave. And it really went better than I could ever imagine.
Yeah, I read the initial article she wrote about your resignation, and I hesitate to even call it an article because it was biased. It was dripping with this certain kind of venom. She mocked your outfit, your tone of voice, described you as having a little girl lisp. Like, it was not a nice article about
you. I was so self-conscious. Do I have a list?
I don't think so, but like,
and
I'm not sure.
I purposely didn't that time because I'm, again, you know, it's like, oh, I don't want anyone to ever make fun of me for this thing, so I'm just going to hide it if it's true. When I was a kid, I did do speech therapy, so like maybe they're pointing to something true. But, you know, whether or not we're, what we're being shamed for is true, like it is so painful. And it's especially painful when it's a woman, right? Because
yeah.
we think women are supposed to have our backs. Yeah, it really, a lot of it, it's interesting. So I had her, that experience with her, and I'm able to connect with her, but, and this is not at all in the book, but I actually dated a reporter from the New York Post for,
oh my
like
goodness.
8 months. I know, years later, but not that many years. You know, I'm not that old. But like, yeah, so I understood that New York City is a small town and people are writers and journalists. And I met someone and he just so happened to work at the New York Post. So I was able to humanize reporters already. And I was already a writer and a journalist to some extent. Like, I know people just are just doing their jobs. But that people, you know, sometimes our jobs really make us divorce ourselves from our ideals. As I knew very well as a woman with experiences in the sex trade, you know, you don't always get to 100% be who you are. So I went into the interview with that knowledge and still the pain. And yeah, it was nice to have that. Ultimately, to be able to connect to someone that I really feared I could never connect to, there's something profoundly healing in that.
Yeah, I don't know if most of us could have sat across the table from her, but you know, you describe how healing from shame is difficult because the nature of it is to make you feel bad about yourself.
Well, first you have to feel the feeling, right?
Right.
You have to recognize this person makes me feel bad. Then we have to sort of identify the trigger. Okay, I can see why, like she's she's like in the, as an example, she, you know, she fits in. She was a White House correspondent. Like, how successful can you possibly be? You know, like, that image is not me in my brain. So knowing your trigger and knowing what you, who you fear you are and who you, desire to be that you fear you're not, that is a first step. So to feel that, and then to allow yourself to be vulnerable. One, also, here's a step, is to really identify where that comes from culturally. So it's not, you know, the word classy, I didn't make it up. You know, it's loaded. That's a term in our culture. And I've been told to feel a kind of way about growing up financially insecure and not having, you know, the things that others had to identify themselves as having wealth. You know, I felt this kind of way for a long time. You know, a lot of the things we feel ashamed of, that trigger was planted early and it's been reinforced again and again by our society, by the culture. So then to sort of be vulnerable enough to admit this is the experience, this is where I feel fear that I'll be judged. And you might be. But oftentimes we're not. Oftentimes instead that it really does create a bridge to others and to a feeling of belonging. So the thing that we fear most, the opposite happens. Instead of being rejected, we're embraced. And actually in this case with that reporter, I was able to hear her own story and her own fears and her own the motives the conditions that mediated the choices that she made in her life. And once we start to recognize those conditions and see a likeness in our conditioning, then we begin to feel more compassion towards others and ultimately towards ourselves.
So how do we teach our children about shame? What can we do to help make them grow up more shame resilient?
So I have two kids. I have a 4-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old son, and they are teaching me things every day. I love exploring feelings with my kids. I didn't when I was a kid. I didn't have a safe place to be and feel. You know, sometimes feelings can feel really scary. To a kid, but also to a grown-up. Like, I don't know how to make you feel better. My son, maybe a year or two ago, five, when he was five or six, he says, Mom, I'm not always going to be happy. I just want you to be happy. I might've said, I'm not going to be happy all the time. Let me not be happy.
Very true.
Right? Brilliant. So really, you know, in the book, I talk about safe containers, finding a safe container for your big feeling, where you can just have that feeling out loud without people rejecting you or leaving you alone. So giving my kids permission to feel their feelings and to have a big feeling out loud without fear of rejection or punishment is a very difficult but important practice.
Yeah, and I like that idea of not feeling alone. I keep coming back to it because in all the different interviews, I think there's like an interview for almost everyone in the book. So if you've never been publicly humiliated by national media, like there are so many different stories of small feelings of shame to really big feelings of shame. And it's, I don't know, in some ways, it's really just nice to know that as weird as it sounds, it's a truly universal experience.
Absolutely. And that was such a beautiful aha for me, that it really was the same feeling, whether you're ashamed, because you know, I can't, the small example is, you know, one of, there's a woman, a child-free woman who orders takeout, and someone on a line, you know, disparages her for that choice, versus, you know, someone who, you know, had a coercive experience with a partner, sexual experience that they internalized and felt responsible for, and then were publicly humiliated amongst their friends. It's the same feeling. It's that same piercing wrongness. And it's the same steps to really get over it, which is to feel that wrongness, to kind of explore it curiously. Where is this coming from? What about me made me vulnerable to this feeling in this moment? What about this, my culture reinforces this? How is it not unique to me? And then really, and this is something I've been practicing for decades now, is to just share it with someone. You know, the second I find myself feeling a kind of way and thinking no one can ever know this. And I used to verbalize that, like, I'm just not going to, like, I'm going to have to lie, or I'm going to have to hide this. And then oftentimes it's not verbal, but we know that feeling. This has to be hidden at all costs. Then I realize I have to tell somebody this right now. Difficult drop-offs were a thing for a long time. I felt like such a bad mom because I had a child with school refusal. He just did not want to go to school. And he would cry and claw and fight to not separate. And I would separate. And that was so hard. And I would just have to find someone right afterwards to talk about what happened so that I just did not feel alone in that moment. Because that's the feeling. It's that feeling of so fundamentally wrong that no one can bear to be with us or love us. And finding someone who will stand next to you and hear that story. That is what begins to loosen it and free it from us.
Throughout the book, you also highlight a variety of books and articles and research on shame, which I also really loved, just kind of getting more, like, for those who are curious about the science of it, it was also really fascinating to kind of think through, oh, okay, this is what we, like, think about how it operates within our bodies and our brains and our society.
So I wrote this book in, like, 8 or 9 months. But I definitely did not. One, I had written a memoir. So that became like, whatever, 30% of it. But also, I went through my journey, all those years of transitioning out of sex work to become a public school teacher, and the steps that I had taken to reconnect to the woman that I was and the values that I had, including like the strong desire to, you know, live a public life, contribute, be a public servant. That took work to free myself from what I'd feared I was good for, to become who I wanted to be. And then again, now the New York Post scandal hits and I have to do all that work again. And I had all of these resources along the way. So all I had to do to write the book was to go back and find the books that I had read and studies, because I intellectualize things. That's my way of kind of protecting myself from shame to a certain extent. You know, I'll think about it so I don't have to feel it. Right. So I had done a lot of intellectualizing, along with somatic work and therapeutic work. And that is also outlined in the book, the steps that I had taken, really to free myself from that prison of shame.
That was Melissa Petro, journalist and author of the book Shame on You: How to Be a Woman in the Age of Mortification. Thank you so much for joining me. And where do we find you online?
Go to Instagram, you'll see beautiful photos and hopefully not always beautiful photos. Melissa Petro, and I'm
Yeah.
everywhere.
Petro. Thank you again so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to say thank you to our All Sides staff who put this together today. Producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz. Our intern producer, Kira Kadar, who will be leaving us soon and who did an amazing job on this show. Thank you so very much. And thank you all for joining me here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.